Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Utah Foundation President Sean Teagan joins us today to talk about housing and health care. A new report from the foundation says that programs that directly reduce purchase prices, such as well-crafted community land trusts and shared equity mortgage programs with public and nonprofit partnerships, are better aligned with today's cost realities than previous solutions. Another report looks at how healthcare costs burden us, the drivers of these costs, and the federal changes that impact us. We'll get into all of that as we go along. Sean Teagan, thanks for joining us again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Let's start with the Utah priorities. You do this survey. Where does housing and healthcare fit in the overall concerns that Utahns have?
Yeah, so the Utah Foundation administers this Utah Priorities Project every 4 years during elections for governor, those years, the gubernatorial election years. And in 2024, which is the last year we administered this, housing costs were at the top of the list. So people in Utah were most concerned about housing costs, and they wanted the government to do something about that. But then when you look back to 2020, and that was, you know, this survey was administered just after the start of the pandemic and the shutdown, healthcare was at the top of the list. And in 2016, and that was in the time of the big discussions around Obamacare and concerns about it not sticking around and concerns about it happening at all. And in 2016, healthcare was also at the top of the list. So it's when we look at the issues that concern Utahns most, healthcare and housing often are at the very top.
Well, we'll talk about those today. Let's start with this report, Appraising Utah's Homeownership Approaches. I'll just read from the beginning of the report. Utah's long ranked above the nation in homeownership rates. However, the state is now at its lowest level in 40 years. We've been shrinking in this in Utah.
We've been shrinking, and you know, this is maybe a little factoid that is just kind of interesting. I find it really interesting. It's that Utah is the only state in the nation that has never been below 60% in terms of people owning their own homes, in terms of homeownership. So we're still above 60%, and we're still above the nation at large, but the gap between us and the nation is shrinking pretty quickly.
And I guess the reason for this is the reasons we have all over the nation. There are increasing hurdles to homeownership.
There are increasing hurdles, and a big one, and perhaps the biggest, and maybe I don't have to put a caveat in there about the perhaps, the biggest is cost. So when you're looking at homes across the United States, we can see those costs increasing over time. And if you look at an index that looks at Utah and the U.S., they've tracked pretty closely over decades and decades. But really, within the past 10 years, that has diverged. So we've seen that Utah's prices have been going up faster than the average price in the U.S. over the past 10 years. And really over the past 5 years, it's exploded, just like other markets, maybe like Idaho and some other places. But we in Utah used to be a relatively low cost market for home ownership, for homes. We are no longer in a low cost or even middle cost range. We're now with the high priced markets like some of those East Coast states and West Coast states and other places in the nation.
Of course, if you talk about housing in a whole, there'd be renters, right? Some people prefer renting, but that's gone up as well, the prices for rents. But we're concentrating on homeownership here, and so this has been the American dream, but maybe it'd be good to outline the benefits of homeownership as you do in the report. What are the benefits?
Yeah, there are all kinds of benefits, and perhaps the most important for a lot of people, it's wealth generation, and that wealth generation comes in our equity of those homes that we own, in large part. But that is one important one for us now in our homes, but it's also important for passing on generational wealth, to our kids and our grandkids and whatnot. It's also important in terms of our overall health. It's important in terms of our access to post-secondary education. We do better both in K-12 education and after high school if we're in homes that are owned. You know, the list goes on and on. They're really looking across the board. We're better off owning homes than we are renting homes. That said, there are some advantages to renting, and so we've written about this in some previous reports. Tom, is that, you know, if we need flexibility because we're moving around because of our jobs or something, you know, it's important to rent. If we want to more easily move into a different neighborhood or move into a smaller home, if we've got kids moving out, or if we want to just have that flexibility of moving into a state that we or a community that we'd like to move into and not be worried about what the market looks like and whether we can sell our homes. But the last one I think is an important one, and that is when home prices are high for owners. And this is particularly the case when you've got a high interest rate on your mortgage. You're better off financially in terms of the money that's going out for your living costs. You're better off renting. And that's not like, you know, I've owned my home for a long time, so I'm not going to quickly go out and rent a house. But if I were buying one today, and I'm perhaps better off renting. The downside of renting is that you're not forced to put money into savings. And whereas when we're owning, we're effectively forced to put money into savings, and that savings is that home that we're living in.
So the two sides of this, the demand and supply, right? And I think you'll say we need to attack both sides. The supply side is where the state is that's where the governor is focusing, I think.
Yeah, the governor's been talking a lot about this in terms of like 35,000 starter kind of entry level homes, making sure we get that ramped up. Supply is also important just in terms of, you know, in regular old, you know, in economics 101, when you're thinking about supply and demand, if the supply is too low for what the demand is, then the price goes up. That price curve it heads on up. So there are a lot of concerns around supply, and there are a lot of people in the legislature and even in cities and towns that are looking to ramp that up in different ways, and there are a lot of methods to do it. This report that we're talking about today, Tom, we focus just on the demand side. So we're focusing not on building more homes, but we're focusing on getting people into homes if they are prospective home buyers, if they're interested in owning their first home.
Let's talk about some of those hurdles, those barriers, and how, in your report, you suggest we overcome them. First, I guess, is a knowledge barrier. I guess some people don't know what's out there, don't know how to proceed.
Yeah, don't know how to proceed and don't know what the risks are. Or don't know what it means if you miss a payment, and don't know, you know, even hunting around for a good mortgage lender or shopping around for good rates. And so that there are organizations out there that are, and this is a pretty low bar in terms of helping people understand things, because it doesn't cost a lot to educate people in terms of the things they need to know when they're either A, looking for a home, or B, when they're finally getting into a home and the things that they got to look out for. So that education hurdle, I think it also can be used, this education piece can be used to get to a couple of the other hurdles and help kind of overcome those in terms of some of the programs that are out there for us.
And there are programs out there, right? Education programs.
There are lots of education programs out there. The key is to finding out where they are, and I think and people probably don't know about these programs, but there are a lot of programs out there, and sometimes they may cost you $75. Sometimes maybe there's $50. Sometimes they're going to be free. There are ones that are locally that you can go visit. There are programs that are online that are run by organizations around the state, and there are some national programs as well that are out there helping people out.
So if I'm a home buyer or potential home buyer, is there a one-stop shop where I can go to find out where these education programs are? I guess you can pull up the Utah Foundation report.
Yes, you can look at some of the work that we do because we talk about some of these education programs. In fact, there's a we include a list of some programs in this report so that people can kind of compare and contrast what they feel what kind of what they're looking for, if they're looking for something that's online or something that's in person. But I think that one of the ways to do this is to start there, but also, just getting out your phone and Googling, and you'll be able to find some programs, perhaps in your neighborhood that you could attend.
Another barrier is financing. I love this sub headline in the report. Can't we just lower interest rates? Wouldn't that
Can't we
solve
just lower
just
interest
solve things? T
rates?
tell me about that.
So interest rates are high, and that causes a lot of problems for Utahns and people around the nation. I'll get to the can't we lower interest rates in just a moment. But this topic that we talk about, this financing, there are programs out there that are helping us get into homes. And one of the largest programs, the Utah Housing Corporation, is out there providing access to mortgages for homes. There's some focus recently on the Utah Housing Corporation to see if they can't get us into homes at a lower interest rate than they're offering currently. Mostly what they're offering are like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac kind of loans that we've all heard about. They're also offering some Veterans Administration loans and other loans for first-time home buyers and lower income homeowners. But we're the state's kind of focusing on seeing if we can't get those lower. And talking about lower income interest rates, if we look back to 6 or so years ago, you could maybe find a home get an interest rate at 3% or less than 3%, and now it's double that. And that really substantially increases the overall mortgage that we're experiencing when we're buying homes. But lowering the interest rate doesn't necessarily work to ameliorate all of our problems, because one of the things that we've seen, and this is what we kind of started the show with, Tom, is looking at the increase in cost of homes, that we are now a high-priced market. If you lower the interest rates, that high-priced market, I mean, it's possible that home prices will just go higher. It's not like they're going to go lower if you lower the interest rates. So you may find that you're getting a better deal on your interest rate, but you're going to have a harder time, and you're going to be in more bidding wars in order to into getting into homes, because you're going to see some home prices perhaps increase. So it's not just about interest rates, but it's definitely part about interest rates. But there's some danger there, and that's the Federal Reserve and others that focus on interest rates in the state, and the mortgage interest rates that are affected by those. It's kind of a dangerous game. There's a big balance you need to a tightrope you need to walk there to make sure that you don't then automatically just shove house prices up.
And you list several programs here for financing programs available to prospective home buyers. Utah Housing Corporation, your local bank, credit union might have a program, so look those up as well. What about down payment assistance? I should caveat this with financing, down payment, any of the things we're talking about today. It can be swamped by just really, really high prices for homes. You may be nibbling on the margins, but
You're nibbling on the margins. That's exactly it, Tom. And that's, when we talk about, we actually talk about kind of four categories of these demand side programs in this report. Education we start with, that we talked about financing, and then down payment assistance. These three nibble at the margins. Down payment assistance is a big deal, and it's been a big deal, and financing has been a big deal for a long, long time. Financing and down payment assistance has gotten a lot of people into homes over the decades, and they're both of these, particularly down payment assistance. It's really helpful in lower priced markets. So if you're buying a home in Canton, Ohio, or Indianapolis, you might be able to, that might really make it all pencil in terms of getting into a house. And these down payment assistance, sometimes they're smaller amounts, sometimes they're $3,000-$5,000, sometimes they're larger amounts. It could be as high as $25,000 or $30,000. They're very helpful, particularly when you need a little bit of help with that initial payment because you don't have the savings. But at the end of the day, you're still stuck in a $500,000 house. You still have a $480,000 mortgage that you have to service, and that down payment assistance isn't going to help with that in the long term, particularly when we've got these, like we were talking about, these high interest rates or relatively high interest rates. And you know, that interest rate thing, to get back to this, they're high compared to maybe what we've been used to over, you know, the previous decade or so, especially from the late 2000s, so 2008 and 2009 after the beginning of the Great Recession. But when you look back to the 80s, you know, interest rates still are very, very low. I know that my parents bought a house in Sandy, Utah in, I think it might have been 1982 or so, and if I remember right, my dad had talked about this before. I think the interest rate was like 16 or 17% or something outrageous like that. So they're high, but they're not as high as maybe they've been at some points in the past.
I still remark, when I remember this, it's with a start. My parents purchased a home in the 60s, I think it was, my old homestead. 16,000. The full purchase price, $16,000. Yeah, yeah. You can't buy a car for that these days. Yeah,
right.
Things change. Right. So the down payment assistance, Utah Housing Corporation, is another player that in the Utah Foundation has a list here. We're talking with Sean Teagan, Utah Foundation president. We're talking right now about housing. Later, we'll get to talking about healthcare. So let's take a break. Following the break, we'll get into some programs that maybe you stop nibbling at the margins, maybe can really help reduce that actual purchase price. We'll be talking about those following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking in this part of the program about housing, specifically a Utah Foundation report study appraising Utah's homeownership approaches. Later in the program, we'll talk about healthcare. And we're talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Teagan. So you note in this report that Utah has been ranked the 9th most expensive housing market in the country. It didn't used to be that way, right? Housing prices just exploded in Utah. Modest homes are costing over $500,000. Many people are just priced out of those homes. So we've been talking about some assistance programs but these kind of nibble at the margins, help you a little bit. Let's get into talking about some programs that could make a meaningful difference in reducing the overall cost of the of a home. Let's start with shared equity, shared equity mortgages.
So shared equity mortgages. We talk a lot about this, and this kind of shared equity mortgage picture was actually kind of the impetus for looking for this report. We wanted to provide some context for thinking about shared equity in various ways. And there are a couple types of shared equity mortgages that are out there right now. And one of them isn't technically a shared equity mortgage, and the other is perhaps a little bit more in that realm. But the first kind is one that I actually received something in the mail a handful of years ago. Just a letter from a group that said, hey, you know, let us buy a part of your mortgage and we'll give you cash and we don't even need to do an appraisal on the house. And it was kind of like a, you know, this it was intriguing. And you know, that wouldn't help me get into a home. That was for a home that I already own. The downside of some of these kind of shared equity mortgage organizations is that ultimately when you add up, And this is effectively what the deal is that they have a lien on a portion of your property. They basically own a portion of your house. So if I were to live in, let's say, a $500,000 house, and they were going to buy maybe a fifth of that, maybe let's say they buy 20% of my house, and then they give me an amount, a cash amount, and I've suddenly got this influx of cash. The downsides of this kind of program is that they come with quite often a lot of fees, and they also will force you perhaps to refinance or you know, sell your home in order to get their money back. So there have been some studies on some of these kind of shared equity mortgage type programs where you'd actually have been better off getting $100,000 of credit card debt and paying off that over a 5 or 7 year period or whatever the contract is with the shared equity firm, because of effectively what you're getting is a high interest loan, and then you pay them back at the end. It sounds better, I think, than it is. The other program that we really talk about and we focus on quite a bit in this report is an organization that has been providing some shared equity mortgages to first-time home buyers in various markets and have moved into the Utah market. It's an organization called Homium. And what they've done is created a fund with some nonprofits and other organizations to let's say I'm looking at, Tom, a $500,000 home, and I cannot, for the life of me, there's no way I can service the mortgage on that thing. I know that I went to the home buyer education program. I got some financing through the Utah Housing Corporation. I got some down payment assistance from an entity to help me out. And at the end of the day, that's all fine and good, but there's no way that I'm going to be able to make the payments on that $500,000 house going forward. What I might do is go to somebody like Homium, and they will buy perhaps 2/5 of this house. So they'll buy $200,000 effectively of a $500,000 house. I'll buy $300,000 of that $500,000 house. We get into that. I get into that home. I'm only paying on that $300,000 proportion, and of course I have to pay for the upkeep and whatnot of the home. When I refinance or sell that home at some point in the future, if it's in 2 years or 20 years from now, then the equity in my home, I get 3/5 of that equity. And then the funder through Homium gets 2/5 of the equity of that home. So there's no extra fees. There's no extra charges. It's not like some of these other organizations where it's like, I should have just taken on credit card debt. Instead, it seems like it's a pretty good deal. And it's something that's kind of ramping up in the state. And then there are some complexities around it. If you give somebody $200,000 of funding and they live in that home for 20 years, then they can't use that $200,000 to help somebody else out and to help somebody else out and to help other organizations out. So the approach that some of the groups that are working with Homium are focusing on is this kind of this taking $200,000 chunk of money and putting it into almost a secondary market so you can buy and sell amounts that are invested in people's homes. So maybe the original investor won't be the investor in that 2/5 of my home always, but they're the initial investor and they may sell that and use some of that money to buy then to help somebody else get into a home. And that $200,000 might be in a bank somewhere or some Silicon Valley bank that's just buying some chunks of homes because they know that the Salt Lake market and the Logan market and the St. George market are good. And so they're looking into investing in these chunks of different homes, maybe in Utah and around the nation.
This sounds like it's promising, but you have to be careful who you invest with, I suppose.
The investors have to be careful. I could be a person that buys a home and suddenly I don't do the upkeep that I need and ultimately maybe that home is foreclosed upon and then the investor may not, they're not getting any upside. They're getting their loan back, but they're not getting any additional equity on that home if we don't gain any equity because I've let it kind of become dilapidated over time. So the investors have to be careful. I think for the buyer's side, you don't really need to worry about who's owning that 2/5. These contracts are written in such that they can't force you to sell your home or refinance. You can do that at your own prerogative whenever you feel the need.
What about rental entry? The different flavors.
This is so cool, Tom. we've got some programs. We've got a program in the state called Rocky Mountain Home Fund, and some developers that are doing some really very cool things. Give development, and I should just say this isn't an advertisement for Give Development. They provide us with some pretty great space for the Utah Foundation, but they're doing some amazing work. So I love to talk about them. This kind of rental entry approach is not really. I don't own a home. I'm renting somewhere, but I'll give you an example of the building that I'm in, the Arbor building on 515 East, 100 South. There are the rental floors are between floors 4 and 11. It used to be a commercial building only, and now floors through 11 are apartments. And if I move into one of those apartments, they're targeted at lower income households. If I move into one of those apartments, after a year, the 75% of the revenue of the profit, I should say, that Give Properties earns, they provide back out to the home, to the renters. So at the end of a year, I may be getting a rebate basically on my rent of $2,000, which is great. And that could be a game changer, especially for a lower income household. But at the end of 15 years, when that property is refinanced and redeveloped, and maybe somebody else purchases it or whatever the case may be, then 75% of the equity in that building is divided up among the renters over that 15-year period on a prorated basis. So that could be a game changer in terms of, like, I could be a renter there for 15 years and in 15 years from now walk out of there with a $200,000 check, just depending on the market, depending on who buys that thing in the future. But that's kind of a game changer. And there's some other cool programs like that that the Rocky Mountain Homes Fund. Rocky Mountain Homes Fund is involved in that property that I brought up, that Give Development property, but they've got some other properties as well that they're involved in. It's some cool, very innovative things that you're seeing in Utah and a couple of the neighboring states that are really happening nowhere else in the United States or really perhaps the world.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tegan. We're talking about their report appraising Utah's homeownership approaches. You can find all of this at utahfoundation.org, the website. This one I have heard about. I've heard about a program in Moab. I understand there's other places in Utah, community land trusts. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so that's kind of thinking about those shared equity mortgages in a slightly different way. So instead of an investor coming in and through Homium and the Utah Dream Fund, maybe purchasing 2/5 of my house, my $500,000 house that I'm looking to buy, instead of that, I'm looking at buying a home on a community land trust. This community land trust, like you brought up Moab. Moab owns some property. Or maybe it was donated, maybe they were donated some property. And on that property, they said, hey, we're going to find some people, some developer to build some homes. And let's say they build 20 homes on this property. I can, and they choose me to move into one of those homes. I'm basically buying a home, but the property I don't own. Instead of the property instead is a long-term lease. So maybe I've got a lease that's up to 99 years for as long as I live in this home. I'm not going to be living in that home for 99 years, but as long as I own this home, I'm basically paying $1 a year for the property, for the ground that the home is on, and I'm just paying for the home, and I've got a mortgage on the home, and that might bring my house down, depending on the market, Tom. That could bring my house down by $100,000 or $200,000, or whatever the case may be. So maybe, let's say, instead of this kind of shared equity model where somebody else owns 2/5 of my house and I'm paying for a $300,000 house, with this situation, I'm also paying for a $300,000 house, and nobody else owns any other part of it. At the end of the day, when I do sell, the only downside to the owner is that there is a limit to how much I can effectively sell that home for. I can't turn around in 2 weeks and sell my $300,000 on the market, and the market rate might be $500,000 for a home that size. Instead, there's a limit to how much equity I can pull out each year from that home. So maybe I can sell that home in 5 years from now and gain, you know, $50,000 on it or whatever the case may be, but not sell it for what it's worth as a home that size in the market. But it's a very cool program. Whereas there are some possibilities of the secondary market where you can buy and sell these pieces and through Homium and the Utah Dream Fund and that sort of approach to a shared equity. There's a little bit more of a limit perhaps in the community land trust realm because there's only so much land that is available and that is desirable that is owned by communities that they then can have homes built on and then sold at this rate. So that there's a little bit more of a constraint there. But I think all these three programs, they're quite different, particularly the kind of the rental entry program. They're quite different, but they can really benefit people around the state. And you know, another benefit of perhaps like that kind of Homium program over a community land trust is that I can look anywhere for a home. Like I can live in one community or the community next to that or the one next to that. And look at any homes when I'm looking to buy a house. Whereas with community land trusts, you're limited to whatever that chunk of land is that those homes have been built on. But it's another cool program. There aren't a ton of them. They've been around for a long time. There aren't a ton of options in the state. But particularly in this high priced market that we're in now in Utah, we may see some more of these pop up as communities want to provide affordable home ownership options particularly for you know, first time home buyers and those younger families. So the younger families don't have to move out of the community or move out of the state, move to Canton, Ohio, in order to buy a home. They can stick around and live here along in Utah.
Noticing a community land trust, I mentioned Moab, there's Summit in Wasatch counties, Salt Lake City, Utah County. There are a few around. So there's limitation, you'd say, on these because of the land. The other programs, shared equity programs, are those scalable to help lots and lots of people instead of just a few?
Yeah. So the idea is that the program that we see now from Homium in the state, and I keep bringing up Homium because that's the only one that's effectively doing it like this in the state at this time. But they're scalable with that kind of secondary market. So when these investments are able to be bought and sold on the market in a relatively easy way. I think there's going to be it's very, very scalable. One way to get there perhaps is to get the state more involved and see if the state coughs up like, you know, a chunk of money. You know, this would cost a lot of money if you were going to give 200,000 of loans out to 100 families. But if you could get 100 families started off in a big way with some state money and with all the philanthropic money and the other funds from nonprofits that are going into this, you could really start to see something happen there. And perhaps that would be enough to get the secondary market really going. And then it's super scalable. And then you might see, you know, in the future, you know, 1 in 10 homes, or maybe even 1 in 5 new homes being bought and sold are shared equity homes. I mean, you could see this as a big, it could be a big investment opportunity for the folks out there with the money. Lots of banks and high net worth individuals and other investment groups. It could be worthwhile for them. It could be worthwhile for them because right now what you're seeing, Tom, is that you see some of these large buyers going in. And if I'm a developer of 20 homes in a community, you might get somebody that comes in and says, I'm going to buy all 20 homes. And then they're renting those homes. So they've got rent that this large organization is then renting those homes. They've got to pay for the upkeep on those homes. They got to pay for the groups that are going and renting to new people. It might be a win-win in terms of people having access to homes that they can afford in the state and people making money effectively on portions of homes on this kind of, I like the round numbers. I like this 2/5, this $200,000 investment in a $5,000 home. It's I think a pretty cool way to make an investment in this kind of housing market.
Well, the report we've been talking about is appraising Utah's home ownership approaches. You can find that at utahfoundation.org. We're talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tegan. Let's take another break. When we come back, we'll be talking about this report, healthcare costs for Utahns, a 2026 update. In this, the Utah Foundation takes a look at health costs, what the drivers of health costs are, and federal policy changes that will be affecting us. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Utah Foundation President Sean Tegan. You can find Utah Foundation, utahfoundation.org. We turn to healthcare. Here's the report, Healthcare Costs for Utahns, a 2026 update. So I guess the first thing in this report, Sean Tegan, is healthcare costs remain a widespread burden. Tell me some of the stats here.
Yeah, so about 7 in 10 Utahns have experienced at least one healthcare cost burden. So that's things like, my household has experienced two of those in the last 5 years. It's one of these things where it's like something surprises you and maybe your insurance doesn't cover it. Maybe you're out of network, whatever the case may be, you weren't prepared for it. Maybe you've got a health savings account and whatever your costs are went far beyond what you have in your health savings account, and so that came out of your own pocket. Or maybe that you're uninsured. So we've at least 7 in 10 of us have experienced one of these healthcare cost burdens, and over 8 in 10 are worried about the cost of future healthcare. So we're worried about how much we're going to be spending, you know, maybe this year or next year and into the future in terms of our health care, or maybe, you know, particularly when we get a little bit older. So we're worried about it. And like I said, when we talked about this at the beginning of the show, Tom, is that Utahns have been worried about healthcare and healthcare costs for a long time. It topped the list of the Utah Priorities Project back in 2016 and 2020.
This is something I've talked about with friends. Even though 92% of Utahns have insurance, approximately 63% have opted to delay or forego health care due to cost. I know that's happening out there.
Yeah, it's a wild thing, and part of that is you know, insurance back in the old days, I guess, we used to have much smaller deductibles. Now, in order to keep our premiums somewhat manageable, and most people wouldn't suggest that our premiums are somewhat manageable, but in order to keep those kind of monthly payments a little bit down, we have these higher, much higher deductibles. And so, yeah, sure, I have insurance, but like, I have to spend $6,000 before it really kicks in. So I'm not going to do this thing, or maybe I'll wait to have a procedure next year at the beginning of the year, so I can see if I can get all my procedures in 1 year in order to meet that deductible. Perhaps we don't have enough money for a certain prescription that's expensive. And we're like, I guess we're going to have to skip that prescription because I don't have the money for it.
Yeah, so I guess out-of-pocket costs, prescriptions, premiums. Some folks are just uninsured. They got to bear the full cost.
Some folks are just uninsured. And one of the things we talk about here is that when you think about when we've asked, in various surveys why people aren't insured, most say it's too expensive, which makes sense. And I think what we're going to see, and one of the things we talk about, you alluded to this when we talk about what this report's all about, is that we're going to see an increase in the uninsured rate in Utah, partly due to some of the federal changes. And so that's one of the things we talk about in this report. Unfortunately, you know, while 92 or so percent of us have been covered in the past year or so, we're going to see a smaller proportion. And so we may see an even larger proportion of people opting to delay or forego healthcare because of costs.
I want to read this as well. 45% of those who did receive the care they needed struggled to afford their medical bills. So people talk about contacted by collection agencies, depleting savings, incurring credit card debt. So, you know, that puts a strain on the finances of a household.
Yeah, and you, when you look at that, these data are a little bit older, but in 2022, 4 in 10 Americans carried some form of medical debt. Even in Utah, the previous year, this is the most recent data we had available, about 14% of Utahns had medical debt in collection. So their medical debt is not a small thing to think about. When we think about the importance, like the topics today, Tom, that you picked for this call, when we think about costs for our homes, you know, most of us, the largest cost that we have, it's our homes. And when we think about healthcare, when you look at GDP, the gross domestic product of the United States, you know, almost a fifth of that is on healthcare costs. And you look at the federal government, and I think its healthcare is just behind Social Security in terms of outliers for or outlays for the federal government. So a ton of money is being spent out there in various ways, and yet we still, at the household level, have a lot of medical debt.
So the report talks about the factors that are driving these increasing healthcare costs. Would it briefly tell us what those factors are?
Yeah. So higher prices. So when we look at prices overall, we're paying more for some of the items that are kind of routine, and we're also spending more for inpatient services that are maybe a little bit less routine. So we're spending more. We're also we've got higher usage of healthcare, and so the higher usage, we're spending more regardless of the higher usage, but we're also spending more because of higher usage on things like prescription drugs and also behavioral health issues for depression and other types of things. We also see that there are higher commercial insurers rates, so we're paying more in terms of the insurance portion of this. And at the end of the day, we're also, you know, all of these higher prices result in and are driving in some ways the administrative complexity, and so we're also paying more just in terms of the administration of healthcare and all the complexity around it at all the different layers in the United States. So there's really no respite. There's no relief from these increases. They're coming at us from all angles.
And, in the report, there's bad news. I think we've seen this expiring tax credits, which Congress has, I think, still not addressed. So those tax credits are expiring.
Yeah. So expiring tax credits. We also look at, during the pandemic, there were some people that had continuous coverage, even they weren't kicked off. They weren't deemed ineligible, even if they became ineligible. So there's some people got kicked off of the government supported healthcare from that kind of unwinding of the pandemic. But we also see that there are some other barriers, and those are things related to the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. So we're going to see some requirements for eligibility that we're going to see more and more people lose their insurance in that way. So there's going to be some eligibility barriers, but then also like you brought up, thinking about the expiring tax credits, you know, we're going to see more and more people that are uninsured due to some of this. And there are some factors that have put in place to hopefully mitigate this to some extent, but at the end of the day, you know, if you don't have insurance and you go, break a leg and either that's going to come out of your own pocket, or if the hospital says, you know, we're going to consider this as uncompensated care, they're going to then raise other people's charges in order to pay for that uncompensated care for uninsured individuals. It's a little bit scary. We got a group of folks together, including some, you know, some advocate kind of folks, but also some hospitals and insurers, and they're all a little bit worried about what's kind of coming down the pike for insurance. The one thing though that kind of comes up is that, you know, at the end of the day, while we spend more in the United States on healthcare than all of our peers, you know, on average, we're at about, 18 to 20% of the GDP I mentioned is spent on healthcare. A lot of our peers, you know, are around 11 or 12%, or some of them are far below that. We do have pretty good healthcare in the state, and when we need it, even if we're not insured, when we need it, it tends to be there for us. And we got to be, you know, feel pretty good about that. We got to feel good that when one of us, you know, gets some kind of a disease, we have pulmonary issues or cancer or whatever the case may be, there are a lot of supports out there to help us through some of those diseases. So I guess that's the one bright shining part of this incredibly expensive system that we're in here with healthcare.
Well, we're reached the end of our time. That's good to end on a somewhat higher note that you just gave us there. We've been talking with Sean Teagan, Utah Foundation president, talking about a couple of their reports. You can find them at utahfoundation.org. Sean Teagan, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure talking to you, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.